Part 2. Product and Strategy.
Chapter 6. Choosing the product,
where most of it is already decided. Welcome back. So in part 1, we drew the map. Why this business humbles people. Why most of them fail. The models you can play. Now the map turns into a decision. And this is the one most people get wrong before they've spent a single euro. Here's the shift. It's no longer about understanding how importing works. It's about making the right call inside that system, because that's where the difference actually gets made. Most failures aren't about execution. They're about the decision that came before the execution. Which product? How it's positioned? Whether it can be differentiated at all? Those three decide the outcome long before any clever optimization ever gets a turn. And almost everybody tries to shortcut this part. The tools spit out clean data. The trends look obvious. Existing products are sitting right there, easy to copy. The approaches aren't even wrong, they're just looked at in isolation. A product is not a standalone object. It's part of a market, a set of expectations, a competitive system. Stare only at the metrics and you miss how fast those metrics move. Copy the original and congratulations, you just inherited all its weaknesses too. So let me kill the first fantasy. You are not searching for the perfect product. The perfect product does not exist. What you're actually doing is picking the least problematic option out of a big field of mediocre ones. Every single option has a downside. Competition, price pressure, a logistics headache, a regulatory trap. The job isn't to find the option with no problems. It's to understand the problems and choose on purpose. People who wait for the flawless product wait a very long time, usually until the market has already moved on without them. Now, why are most products not good products? Because beginners look at them in isolation. It sells well, it's got great reviews, the margin looks juicy at first glance. What's missing is context. A product that sells well automatically attracts competition. A fat margin looks attractive to everyone, which is exactly why that margin shrinks faster than you planned. And good reviews don't mean the thing is easy to sell. They mean somebody already poured serious time and money into it before you showed up. The problem is never the product, it's the dynamics around it. Which brings us to the tools. Research tools give you a feeling of control. Demand, competition, price history. It all suggests the right decision can just be calculated. The data isn't wrong, it's incomplete. Tools show you what worked yesterday. They do not show you what happens once 20 other sellers read the exact same data and make the exact same move. A good product isn't one that sells. It's one that still works when more sellers pile in. And no dashboard on earth will show you that. There's a whole chapter coming on this one, because it's where the most money quietly leaks out. Quick one on competition, because people get it backwards. Everybody hunts for the product with the least competition. Sounds smart. Usually it just means low demand or a structural problem nobody mentions. Competition itself isn't a bad sign. It's proof that demand exists. What matters is the type. Strong brands locking down the market? Hard entry. A pile of interchangeable sellers with no clear positioning? Now there's a gap you can actually walk into. Not all competition is avoidable, but not all competition is worth entering. And here's the line I want burned in. Whether a product can be differentiated is decided at selection, not later in the branding. Pick something with no room for your own spin, and you've boxed yourself in before the first order. You can hire the best designer alive. Doesn't help if the product has nowhere to go. Two quick traps and then the takeaway. First, complexity. It's tempting to think a more complex product means a better opportunity. More features, more detail, more options. In practice, complexity mostly just multiplies your failure points. More components, more things that break. More requirements, more discipline needed. A simple product executed cleanly beats an overloaded product with fuzzy specs every time. Second trap, and this one's expensive. Regulatory classification. Certain categories drag extra requirements with them. Certifications, material rules, labeling obligations. These are not optional and you cannot tack them on afterward. They have to sit in the decision from day one. A product can look economically beautiful and be a regulatory nightmare at the same time. And finding that out at customs is never a fun surprise. The full machinery there is its own serious chunk of the book. Here, just hold the principle. It belongs in the decision, not after it. So, the takeaway for the whole chapter. Finding the right product doesn't mean having the best idea. It means understanding the consequences of a decision before you make it. Every product comes with challenges. Ignore them and you're deciding on hope. Factor them in and you're deciding on structure. And over the long run, that's the only difference that pays. Chapter 7, Market Understanding versus Tool Dependency. Okay, we touched the tools a minute ago. Now let's stand on that one properly, because this is where good people quietly hand their judgment to a dashboard. Research tools are standard now. Demand, competition, pricing, trends. Used right, genuinely useful instrument. Used wrong, they become a substitute for actually understanding anything. And the trouble starts the moment a number gets treated as a decision. Tools show you data points. They don't tell you why a market behaves the way it does. Stare only at the metrics and you see results, never causes. And if you don't understand the cause, you're treating symptoms, like taking aspirin for a broken leg. So let's be fair about what tools are good at. They make patterns visible. What sells, how prices move, how crowded the space is. That's real value. It gives orientation. It keeps you off the obvious landmines. What they can't do is explain the dynamic. Rising sales could be a season, could be a two-week trend, could be real, durable demand. Without context, a number just sits there. A product with good data isn't automatically a good product. It's a product that worked in the past, past tense. Hold that thought. Because here's the trap people walk straight into. They take past performance and project it forward. It's selling great today, so obviously it keeps selling great. And that ignores the one factor that ruins the math. Reaction. The instant the product gets flagged as good, more sellers pour in. Prices slide, differentiation thins out, competition sharpens. The very data that made you decide changes because you decided, along with everyone else who owns the same tool, reading the same screen, making the same move. It's a room full of people congratulating themselves for independently having the identical idea.
So where does real understanding live? Outside the tool.
A market isn't made of numbers. It's made of customers, expectations, and alternatives. To know whether a product makes sense, you have to know why people buy and why they pick one option over another. That means going into the reviews, the use cases, the complaints that keep showing up. What criticism repeats? What expectation keeps getting missed? Where does the frustration build? Because that, right there, is where your differentiation lives. Tools show you what sells. Understanding shows you why. Only one of those two you can act on. Same logic on competition. Most people count it. Number of sellers, number of reviews, the price level. Incomplete. It's not just how many sellers. It's how they are positioned. Clear market leaders with strong brands? Or a crowd of identical products with no visible difference? Are problems actually being solved or just managed? Competition isn't a number. It's a behavior. Read it. Don't tally it. And trends. Tools love showing you a curve going up and to the right. Growth, opportunity. Easy to forget that a lot of trends are short-lived. A product can spike on social media, a season, some platform quirk. Walk in too late and you arrive at a market that's already normalizing. Not every trend is a market, and not every market stays standing. Unfortunately, the curve never tells you which one you're looking at. Bottom line, data is a clue, not an answer. The decision only happens in the interpretation. A product with moderate demand but a weak, sloppy field of competitors can beat a high-volume product surrounded by sharks. A boring, stable market can be worth far more than a loud, volatile trend. Context decides whether you read the data right or just read it the comfortable way. React only to numbers and you march in lockstep with the market. Understand the market and you can choose to step away from it. The difference was never in the data. It's in the person reading it.
Chapter 8. Differentiation instead of copying. Alright, we keep circling one word, so let's land on it. Differentiation. The thing that decides whether you own a position or just rent a spot in the price war. Start with the temptation. Copying is the most natural strategy in this whole business. A product sells well, so you replicate it, nudge it slightly, put it back up. The logic is airtight, right? If it already works, it should just work again. And short term, it does. You get into the market, the first sales land, feels validated. The problem shows up later. Once a bunch of sellers run the same play, you get a market of nearly identical products. And identical products lead to identical decisions, almost always about price. And in a price fight, it's rarely the smartest who wins. It's whoever can stomach the thinnest margin. That's not a strategy. That's a contest to see who bleeds slowest. Because here's what a copy really is. It doesn't just inherit the product's strengths. It inherits the weaknesses too. But without the head start, the original had. And the pure copy has no position of its own. No reason for a customer to pick it, except maybe a slightly lower price, which drops your whole strategy onto one single lever. And price is not a stable advantage. It can be undercut tomorrow by anyone, and it eats your margin while it lasts. Margins shrink a lot faster than they get built. So flip the timeline. Differentiation is usually treated as a later step. First pick the product, then figure out how to stand out. It's the other way around. The potential to differentiate is a property of the product itself. Some products you can meaningfully change, extend, reposition. Others give you nothing. Choose one with no room and you've kept yourself before the first order. A product without differentiation potential isn't a challenge. It's a dead end. Quieter than a wall, but just as final.
Now carefully, because people confuse differentiation with creativity. New colors, a little design tweak, an extra feature nobody asked for. Looks like improvement. But the question is never, is it different? It's, is it relevant to the customer? Relevant differentiation solves an existing problem or meets an expectation better. And that means you actually have to understand the problem. Back to the reviews, the use cases, the complaints that repeat. Not every change is an improvement. Most of them are just variations wearing a fresh label. And the good news? You don't need to reinvent anything. Small, targeted adjustments stacked together make a clear difference. Material, packaging, ease of use, who it's actually for. Add the levers people underrate. A bundle that raises perceived value without touching the core product. Sustainability, when it's done credibly instead of as a sticker. Even a small shift in the usage context can turn an interchangeable product into a positioned one. The key word is consistency. Random tweaks look arbitrary. Several small changes pulling in the same direction, that's a coherent whole. Differentiation isn't one move, it's the sum of a lot of decisions. Two more pieces and a warning. Positioning. A product differentiates not just through what it is, but through how it's perceived. Audience, use case, communication. Two nearly identical products land completely differently if one's aimed at beginners and the other at pros, even with the same function. Differentiation happens in the context, not only in the object.
And price, one more time, because people keep reaching for it. Being cheaper feels like the easy way to stand out. It's the unstable way. A lower price can always be undercut, and it shrinks your room for error, for investment, for development. You've probably heard the red ocean, blue ocean thing. Red ocean, brutal competition, everything comparable, price pressure. Blue ocean, low competition, clear differentiation. Here's the part that stings. Most markets start as blue oceans and end as red ones. And if all you do is copy, you're swimming toward the red. A stable price doesn't come from undercutting. It comes from perceived value. Last thing, and don't skip it. Differentiation only counts if it's visible. A better product means nothing if the customer can't see the difference. The benefit has to be explainable, the difference obvious. If the customer doesn't see the added value, economically, it doesn't exist. Differentiation that isn't visible isn't differentiation. It's a well-kept secret, and secrets don't sell. Bottom line, copying is easy precisely because it asks nothing of you, which is exactly why it falls apart over time. No differentiation, no position to defend. Differentiation isn't a creative garnish, it's the prerequisite for stability. And it starts at product selection and runs through every decision after. Copy and you rent the market for a short while. Differentiate and you shape it. One bridge before we move on. Choosing a product is a decision. Executing a product is a process. And between the two sits the part everybody underestimates. Turning an idea into a precise, manufacturable spec. The product's decided. The factory is ready. The rest feels like paperwork. It is not paperwork. It's where controllable and left to chance get separated. A product doesn't exist because it was imagined. It exists because it was defined, which is the next chapter.
Chapter 9. Product development and optimization. So you've chosen, now you have to define. And this is where a clean idea quietly turns into an expensive misunderstanding. Most common cause of production problems? Assuming the idea is already clear enough. High quality, sturdy, better than the competition. Sounds crisp, right? In execution, it's wide open to interpretation. Manufacturers don't build from intentions, they build from specifications. Dimensions, materials, tolerances, colors, functions, all of it concretely defined. Anything you leave ambiguous gets filled in with an assumption. And the factory's assumptions almost never match the picture in your head. Whatever you don't specify, someone else will interpret. Usually the person trying to hit a deadline, not your vision. That's the real handoff. Product selection answers what gets sold. Development answers exactly how it looks and works. And it's critical because it's the foundation for everything downstream. A bad spec doesn't just hurt production. It hits quality, cost, packaging, and in the worst case, regulatory approval. A sloppy start almost never produces a clean result. Water doesn't run uphill later just because you'd like it to.
Now, optimization. Developing a product doesn't mean changing it for the sake of it. It means improving it on purpose. And the starting point is existing weaknesses in the market. Reviews, feedback, real user experience, they hand you the indicators for free. Wobbly component, awkward handling, a function nobody can figure out. These aren't one-offs, they're patterns. Spot the pattern, fix it, and you're not building a new product, you're building a better one. Which, by the way, is the only kind worth building. And resist the reflex. The reflex is add features, more functions, more options, more complexity. Looks like progress. It also raises the bar on development and production. Every feature is a new failure point. More coordination, more misunderstandings, more demanding quality control. Complexity is not an advantage unless it's under control. A clearly defined, simple product is usually more robust than an overloaded one. More buttons just means more things that can be pressed wrong. Here's the mindset that actually works. Development is iterative. It is not a one-shot. First versions are rarely right. They are the basis for adjustment. Samples, tests, feedback, not optional extras, central to the whole thing. They show you where your assumptions and reality disagree. Try to define the perfect product from your desk on day one, and you're working against the process. You just produce expensive prototypes, while you wait for inspiration that isn't coming. The full sampling sequence, concept sample through golden sample, that's its own part of the book later. For now, just internalize. You iterate toward it, you don't summon it, and it never fully ends. Even after the first successful production run, you're not done. Markets shift, competitors adapt, customer expectations move. A product that works today can be under pressure tomorrow. Continuous optimization isn't a sign you're unsure. It's the price of staying stable. Stand still on a product long enough and the market quietly makes it interchangeable. Nobody sends you a memo when that happens. Bottom line, product development isn't a creative act. It's a structured process. It starts with a precise spec. It's grounded in real problems. It advances through iteration. Take it seriously and you cut uncertainty and keep control of the outcome. Underestimate it and you've handed big parts of your product over to chance. And chance is not a business model.
Chapter 10. The product lifecycle. Timing is everything. Last stop in product and strategy. And it's the one that quietly decides whether a good product makes you money or just makes you busy. Timing. First, kill the static thinking. A product is not a finished state. It's a system that moves. Demand shifts, competition adapts, positioning changes. Treat a product as static and you've already lost the time dimension. You just don't know it yet. People make import decisions as if a product will perform the same way forever. A strong start gets read as confirmation. A dip gets treated as a crisis. In reality, both are usually just normal stages. A product doesn't have a fixed performance. It has a phase. And phases have this inconvenient habit of ending, usually right when you've finally gotten comfortable. So here are the phases, because they repeat with almost boring reliability. It starts with launch. Product's new, competition's thin. The first sales come from curiosity and visibility. Margins look great, stability is low. It feels fantastic, which is exactly what makes it dangerous. Then growth. More sellers arrive, demand climbs, the product gets visible, and the competition starts to organize. First differentiations show up. Price comparisons multiply. The party's getting crowded. Then maturity. The market's established. Competition is high. Products start looking alike. Margins are under pressure. Now efficiency beats innovation and small differences decide who survives. The ones who can't deliver get filtered out. Quietly, but thoroughly.
And at the end, saturation or decline. Demand stalls, new alternatives show up, the product loses relevance. React too late and you're standing in a market that already left. And you usually find out through the bank account. It's a terrible place to get the news. Here's the most common, most expensive mistake. People enter a product when it's visibly successful. Totally understandable. Also often the exact moment the market tips. Competition's rising, prices are falling, differentiation's getting harder. You didn't enter at the start of the cycle. You entered in late growth or already in maturity. The original margins, barely reachable. The requirements, still climbing. A good product at the wrong time is still a bad business, even if the spreadsheet looked gorgeous.
So the real skill isn't spotting every trend early. It's reading where a market stands right now. And you can read it from signals. A young market looks different from a saturated one. Few sellers, inconsistent quality, thin reviews, lazy listings. In growth, more sellers, quality improves, first brands appear. And when it tips into saturation, everything converges. Products, prices, presentation. Eventually, everyone's fighting over the last half cent. And this is where the tools finally earn their keep. They show you how the average price and the number of sellers for a keyword moved over months. Price dropping steadily, while new sellers keep arriving? That's saturation, clear as day. Demand rising but still very few sellers? That's a market at its beginning. The tool doesn't make the call. It just shows you which phase you'd be walking into. And that changes everything. Enter too early, you're paying to educate a market that isn't buying yet. The demand hasn't woken up. Enter too late, you walk straight into a price war that eats your margin. Or you're sitting on stock nobody wants. The right moment is somewhere in between, and you'll never see it in a single number. You see it in the trend. One number is a snapshot. A trend is a direction. Only one of them tells you where you're standing.
Two quick closers. Optimization rides along the whole cycle. What wins at launch isn't enough at maturity. Yesterday's differentiation is today's baseline. Early phases want clear differentiation and fast moves. Later phases want stability, cost control, targeted tuning. The focus shifts from growth to defense. A product only stays relevant if it moves with the market. And the market does not wait for you. And knowing when to change. The hard question is when to adapt, extend, or replace. Most people hold on too long because it once worked. Humanly understandable, economically risky. The market doesn't grade your history. It responds to current relevance. Change too late and you don't get a dramatic crash. You lose ground gradually without a single visible break. Stagnation rarely announces itself. It shows up in comparison. And by the time you can see it, it's already expensive. Bottom line, a product is not a one-time project. It's an ongoing process. The life cycle decides which decisions land and which ones stopped working a while ago. Understand the phase and you can steer on purpose. React only to outcomes and you're following the market with a lag. And in this game, lag is rarely on your side. Okay, before we leave strategy and get our hands dirty, let me give you the whole map in one breath so you can see how every piece coming up connects.
The real import process, start to finish. Product idea and strategy. That's what we just did. Market understanding, differentiation, business model. Then finding and evaluating suppliers. Sourcing, platforms, manufacturer selection. Then the brief and specification. Production preparation, the technical documentation. Then sampling and validation. Concept sample, functional sample, the golden sample. Then production and quality control. Manufacturing, inspection, production approval. Then the serious part, law and regulatory compliance, CE, GPSR, labeling. Then packaging and producer responsibility. Then logistics and import, transport, Incoterms, customs, HS codes. Then negotiation and protection, pricing, contracts, protecting your intellectual property. And finally, reordering and scaling, supplier development and back around the life cycle. Every step stands on the one before it. And here's the line worth remembering. When people hit a problem at step 5, the root cause is almost always sitting back at step 3 or 4. The container doesn't betray you at the port. It betrays you because of a decision you made months earlier in a quiet room with a spec you didn't tighten. That's the whole reason we did strategy first. So, you now know how to think about a product, why most of them aren't good. Why the tool is a servant, not a boss. Why differentiation starts at selection. Why a spec is the real product. And why timing quietly decides the rest. That's the strategy. Now comes the search. Next, we go hunting for the people who'll actually make your product, the factories. Spoiler, some of them are exactly who they say they are, and some of them are a very nice website attached to a very different reality. I'll show you how to tell the difference. See you in part 3.